What is up, listeners? Matt Spraker here, high up in Denver, trying to give a little introduction to give some background to our episode here. In the last 18 or so months, maybe because of my job change or some other current events, I've been thinking a lot about physician leadership and cancer programs and other healthcare organizations. I listened recently to an interview of ASCO CEO Cliff Huddis on the Healthcare Unfiltered podcast. You should definitely check that out. I highly recommend it. The title topic is the ongoing maintenance of certification gate, so to speak. But the episode really is a big discussion about how he leads the ASCO organization and how they are responding to the ongoing discussion. I fired off this episode to our cold light chat, and Simmel, as he does, reached out to make friends and invite him on the show. And of course, he agreed. They always do. He donated over an hour of his time to discuss a huge range of topics that are front of mind for Simmel and I. And after this episode, I hope maybe a bit more front of mind for you too. The world in which we care for patients is changing rapidly. I guess I'm biased, and I really do respect all of our non-physician colleagues, but I think physicians should probably be the loudest voice in the healthcare room. They don't really teach us how to use our voices in medical school, but as Cliff points out, it's easier than ever to learn. The level of young physician talent in this field is really high, and there are so many ways to have an impact, so I really look forward to seeing how my peers drive radiation oncology forward as it evolves into the future. All right, without further ado, I hope you enjoy the show. For many of us, the last thing on our minds is billing. Our pal Jason Bechta is a notable exception. But having a grip on the department's finances is crucial. Radformation's quick code can make billing management a cinch, structuring your billing codes in an intuitive and predictable way. They've seen clinics with errors and misbilling totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars. Are you that far off? Find out. They offer a comprehensive pilot program tailored to your individual department that can give valuable insights on your billing compliance. Find out more at radformation.com. Welcome to the Accelerators Podcast. We're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. The discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. The Accelerators is part of the Photon Media family of podcasts. You can check out all of our shows at photonmedia.org. All right, welcome back to the Accelerators podcast. We have a very, very exciting guest today. I'm looking forward to this discussion. This is Matt Spraker. I'm a radiation oncologist in Denver, Colorado.
I'm Simmel Parikh, radiation oncologist at Lake Huron Medical Center and also medical director at OncoHealth, a digital health company.
And I am Cliff Huddis. I'm a medical oncologist. I was a breast cancer specialist for most of my career, serving as chief of breast cancer medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering for about 18 years. But since 2016, I've been serving as a full-time CEO of the American Society of Clinical Oncology.
Awesome. Thank you very much for joining us today. And I think you might actually be the first time we've had a medical oncologist on the show, but we've invited you on to talk also about your extensive leadership career, and you've done some awesome things. And I think this is the topic that I'm very personally interested in. So I'm excited to kind of hear about your thoughts with leadership in healthcare and physician leadership specifically. Why don't we actually start by sort of hearing a little bit about your history and your career. So I originally heard about you, or kind of heard you speak for the first time actually on the Healthcare Unfiltered podcast, which you did recently. I definitely encourage people to go listen to that. I know that the topic as titled is about maintenance of certification, which has kind of been a hot topic, but you shared a lot of other things about your career and thoughts about physician leadership and organized medicine. What inspired me to ask you to come on the show is that you shared this anecdote on Healthcare Unfiltered where you talk about how you noticed pretty early on in your career that policy impacts medical care in a very acute way, kind of in the clinic. And so presumably that kind of inspired you to go look for some of these other routes where you might be doing policy or leadership in medicine. And you started out, looks like, serving as the vice president for government relations and chief advocacy officer for Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which I think is where you worked at the time. And then now you're ASCO CEO.
You've also been CEO of the Conquer Cancer Foundation. Can you comment on your decision to kind of reduce your time in clinical care and work in some of these leadership roles?
I can. It's probably a longer story, and maybe it's both a little bit unconventional and also, to be very frank, a little less purposeful at the beginning than it might look at the end.
Okay.
So let me just back up a little bit, if I may take a moment. I went to a medical school. I was accepted to medical school as a high school senior. And the reason for that was that there was a six-year BAMD program in Pennsylvania that I got into. And I make that point to say that I only went to college for 2 years before I was already in medical school. Where I went to medical school served a mixed community, but certainly had a huge proportion of deeply underserved patients. And I saw immediately during my internal medicine residency some of the broad challenges that people faced trying to obtain just standard routine medical care. And I mean diabetes, high blood pressure, all the basics of internal medicine. Once I decided to go into medical oncology, which was after 4 years of residency, including a chief residency role, I went to New York to Memorial Sloan Kettering. And I did that driven, of course, by the famed reputation of the organization, but also by the clear vision that I had to take part in what looked like an emerging and multi-decade revolution in oncology care. I want to be very clear, by no means that I see specifically the kinds of technology advances that would define modern medical oncology, but I also did see, along with many others, that something was afoot. It was going to be an exciting era. And the early part of my career in breast cancer specifically, and I mean from roughly 1988 when I started as a fellow until maybe 2010, that window, if you think about it in terms of systemic therapy for breast cancer, was filled with breakthroughs. In short order, growth factor became available. BRCA was discovered and made into a clinical test. HER2 was made into a targetable, effectively targeted avenue for revolutionizing the treatment of breast cancer. New hormone therapies, including the aromatase inhibitors, came along. And I'm probably forgetting something. Of course, the taxanes, I should say, at the beginning of all that, which were the first mega drug in medical oncology. And what's interesting in reflection is that all that unfolded over a pretty short period of time, and you saw a revolution, and you've seen it play out with a 25 to 40% reduction in breast cancer mortality from its peak in 1991. So that's background. After about 2010, as I was assuming a leadership or well into my leadership role at Memorial, and I was really trying to mentor people who were picking up various pieces of what had been at times areas of research that I did, I became very close to, as a collaborator, an investigator across the street from Memorial at Weill Cornell named Andy Dannenberg. And he was a gastroenterologist focusing on inflammation in the gut, and specifically those classic diseases, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, and more. And narrowly focusing on the impact of anti-inflammatories, specifically the newly available targeted drugs aimed at COX-2. And we found nexus between that and breast cancer. But I'm walking through this little bit of science because of something bigger that happened. In the years around that we were collaborating, we made some observations regarding a low-grade inflammation that's common in the white adipose tissue of many, many people in the West, including those who are conventionally measured as obese based on body mass index, but also many people who weren't. And the rising rate of obesity in the country at that time caught our attention. And this was long before the now widely available drugs for obesity were in the clinic. But at the time, there was lots of discussion about them in their development. And to be very frank, not taking anything away from these drugs, I became concerned about the fact that we were developing likely expensive drugs that would be required for large groups of people in the West as a response to what was at root a public policy issue. And the public policy is as simple as the corn subsidy. Because of the effectiveness of farm policy in the United States, we have achieved something that's never been seen before in the West, which is the wide-scale distribution of high-calorie, cheap foods. And in some ways, that is at least a partial cause of the obesity, let's call it epidemic. And it's not limited to the U.S. It's true around the world. But it's also a simple truth that there's never been a time in the history of humankind when there's been such a great proportion of people with elevated BMI. And this is a cancer issue because, of course, after tobacco control, weight and exercise and lifestyle are, as a single entity, let's say, the second leading modifiable risk factor for cancer.
Yeah.
So I got dragged into this that way philosophically. A smaller point, and I'll just close with this, is that through the middle of my career, through multiple administrations, both R and D, we saw flat dollar funding at the NIH and the NCI. And over that decade, what we saw as a consequence was about a 25% loss of purchasing power. And this, again, as a public policy, really concerned me because I would just point out that post-World War II American leadership in the world was built on an unprecedented investment in science and technology. And without discussion, without purpose or in clear intent, we seem to be ceding that leadership or choosing to cede it, I should say. So those two things, those two public policy things turn my attention to Washington. So it sounds grandiose. And I wouldn't presume to have had any impact on either of those things, but I would say that after I had the opportunity to serve as the on the board of directors and then as the elected president of ASCO, I had a little tiny glimpse into the way in which physicians and professional societies could favorably influence some of these policies given time and resources. And that's the end of the story. That's what motivated me to think about this career change.
When I was graduating residency, I saw a person speak just in this open town hall thing. It was in Seattle. It's this Dr. Prabhjot Singh, who's in New York. You may be familiar with the name. He has this pretty well-known book, Dying and Living in the Neighborhood, which is kind of all about these public health initiatives that took place in New York. Got me very interested in kind of what you were talking about. And then I think a lot of our listenership, it probably resonates with them that there's limitations in funding as well. And that's a perennial thing that we lobby for, I think, is where they increase funding, especially in radiation oncology, where we feel like there could be more relative to some of the other oncologic specialties. But I will sort of keep us on track. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit specifically, like when, as you sort of got interested in this, you started taking these roles, did you think a little bit about balancing, you know, inevitably you can't do everything, right? So if you're working as a medical oncologist or a physician, could you, did you struggle at all with like taking time away from clinic to do some more of these leadership roles? Or is that something that you thought about as your career was advancing?
Well, so I won't be nearly as verbose now. I told you the whole story in the beginning. So, and you can probably edit that out if you want. But so I think a common thread in academic, at least in medical oncology, and probably across the physician community, is that people find themselves in positions of leadership because of aspects of success that are or are not related to their leadership abilities.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a common issue, and it's an opportunity for us to begin to address it. So for me, of course, I was in a highly charged, successful academic environment. And given that, I was only in clinic from by expectation for 2 days a week at the beginning of my career. And later it went down to 1 day per week. And I'll add parenthetically, even after I moved to ASCO, because I enjoy clinic and I think the interaction is both rewarding and helpful as an unpaid volunteer, I still see patients one or two afternoons a month.
That's really cool. That's something that I think a lot of people would aspire to do. That's really rewarding to do that. Do you feel like as you've progressed over the last, I guess it's almost 10 years, you said you started this leadership, these leadership roles in 2016. Do you feel like your views on how physicians engage policy, engage, industry, do you feel like that's changed? Have your views on that changed since you started?
Well, first of all, at the risk of sounding immodest, I'll just point out I was made chief of breast cancer in 1998. So okay. I have been in various institutional leadership roles for long before. I served in a variety of roles in the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, including as the co-chair of the breast committee with my good friend and currently ASCO's board chair, Eric Weiner. I served on ASCO committees, including in leadership, and then was elected to the board of directors. Then served as the, and by the way, I should say, when I was elected to the board of directors, I happened to be elected into the treasurer's role, which was an additional learning opportunity. Specifically, then I served as the president. And only after that did I step away from a traditional academic career into the role of CEO at ASCO. Mm-hmm. And I say all that just to say it's not a recent thing. It actually has been an evolution, but there are some relevant learnings. One of the challenges I think we all face in academic medicine is that we're inside a very big, multi-layered, hierarchical organizations. There are a lot of people who are providing direction and setting strategy and goals. And I think that it's a challenge sometimes for physicians to make sure that their voice and their knowledge is incorporated into that. At least that was always a bit of a struggle for me. I'll close this part by saying we don't always have the right language because, of course, we typically hadn't gone to business school. We typically haven't learned some of the basics of management and administration, which are the mainstay of that work on the other side. And it's not a question of battling it out. It's just a question of speaking the same language, knowing what we're talking about, understanding what's important. And that's the opportunity for us as physicians, is to recognize that potential deficit and do things to try to fill it.
So, Dr. Go ahead. Yeah, I've talked to some younger docs recently. We had a few on the show. And this idea of getting into leadership at a younger age or a younger stage of career, there's an issue. Like, it seems like, all right, well, you don't have the experience to be a leader. So you're going to start out on this junior track and you can like read a book or watch a webinar on leadership. I feel like that it becomes really hard to actually engage in an activity. It's sort of a circular thing unless you're in the right circles or you have the right mentors. It's always like, well, you need experience to do this. Read a book. Like, I don't know, trying to read a book about pickleball, it's just not going to make you a good pickleball player, you know, or watching people play. You got to play. You got to engage. And how do you think younger docs, you know, not everybody's going to get the chance to be chief of breast at Sloan Kettering, but do you have any thoughts on what a junior faculty or a junior, even a community practice doctor may do to have the performance skills of a leader?
Well, first of all, everybody's a leader. In various ways, we are, even if it's of nobody else, you're leading your life. You are playing some leadership role, presumably in your family. And that's not to say there's only one, but I think that we have to demystify this a little bit. The second thing is, depending on how narrow and hierarchical an organization is, it is not the case that everybody leads the organization or could expect to do that. And I do think that there is experience that you have to accumulate, and some of it you can only accumulate with the passage of time. You did hit on the probably single most important thing, which I have up till now neglected to mention, and that is to have the good luck to happen upon the right mentor. And for me, it's a very public thing. I came to Memorial in 1988 in July as a new fellow, and in the fall of that year, the then physician chief, Vince DeVita, hired from across town a breast cancer lymphoma maven by the name of Larry Norton. And I was the second fellow in Larry's clinic, is my recollection. And we bonded and hit it off. And it is, you know, now coming up on 40 years later, it's 35 years later, and he's still my mentor, who I still talk to all the time for guidance and advice. And you need more than one mentor. You need different mentors with different perspectives, and you need different types of mentoring at different times in your career. But I actually think that's a tough one, because not everybody has the good fortune to be at the right place at the right time and bond with the right mentor.
Could I ask, so I think other than having good luck or having a fateful meeting with the right mentor, which I think I agree is like super important, can you think back on some sort of high yield things that you might have done that helps people sort of train for these things? I do think Simmel makes a really good point that you do need just to have some experience, that you can't read it all in books or do, you know, simulated face-to-face management scenarios, things like that. But are there things that you've done? I can do the thing of shouting out. I know people are very highly praising ASCO's leadership program. I know that the society offers one. There's another one that radiation oncologists should know about. That's the ESTRO, the European Society. They do a leadership program that's like people rave about it in our field. But other than those kind of, you know, society provided leadership training boot camps, are there other things that you can think back that have been helpful for you?
Well, I think there's really two questions there. What's been helpful for me, and also what has actually become more broadly available for others? In that latter regard, I think the world has gotten better, because the ASCO Leadership Development Program, of which we're so proud, it wasn't even launched until about 2008, if memory serves. So it's a pretty recent program. It's very intense. It's full year. It takes a lot of time, and it's therefore can't be too large. And that makes it tough, because while many people could benefit from it, only a subset are luck of the draw able to get in any year. And scaling it beyond that is obviously a sustainability challenge. But the good news is, in recent years, I've noticed a proliferation of programs, both in local communities and within leading institutions. It is typical now for bigger institutions to offer physicians leadership training. It may not be the same depth or duration as the ASCO program, but there are a lot of business basics management learning opportunities that I would strongly encourage interested people to take. And I'll say that for two reasons. There's a parallel for me between this and communication skills. And you'll say, what is he talking about? Well, if you've ever done press training, narrowly, it's about how you talk to reporters and get your message across. However, it is broadly a critically useful skill for all manner of communication, from the death and dying discussion with patients and families to the difficult career discussions with people that report to, and also to reporters asking questions. So in the same way, I think learning a little bit of these leadership business management skills that, again, I alluded to before, are part of the institution's thinking, I think gathering that information for ourselves is a great, great opportunity. I've spoken long enough now. I forgot the first part of your question, because I said I was going to answer the second part first. It was related.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had asked about any other high yield things that like a young
physician. Well, so that's what I did. All right. So I did answer that. That's what I think is the issue. And the other thing is, I do think, I'll just say that, you know, not everybody wants to do these things. And so people that don't want to shouldn't feel bad about that. It's time and effort, and, you know, spending your time in the lab, making discoveries, treating patients, being there for everybody all the time. These are equally worthwhile. It's just a question of what you want to be doing.
The business aspect of it, I mean, running a department is like running a small business more than anything else. Yet there's this like badge of honor that physicians take. Well, I don't know anything about the business. I don't know anything about reimbursements. I was an econ major. I'm super fascinated by this stuff. I like looking at the books. But not only, like, you don't have to like it. Unfortunately, this is 20% of GDP in America. This is a big business. And would you think it should be part of the training in some part of the medical process, either medical school or residency or somewhere through? Because I've talked to docs that don't have the basics of Econ 101, like supply demand.
Yes. I couldn't agree more, but it resonates with me because I loved econ in my brief college career, and I find it really interesting, and I spend a lot of time reading, listening to podcasts when I'm driving, whatever. It does interest me, and I do think if you think about 4 years of medical school, an afternoon on how to read a P&L wouldn't be a bad thing.
Yeah. I would think that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff careful to say it, like softer stuff that we have in medical school. A lot of times we're so overworked and overburdened during, you're trying to memorize everything. And then you have these like, how to be a compassionate person, like for a 2 hour block. And maybe, you know, maybe teaching compassion is a little bit different than like teaching econ, you know, like I don't know necessarily like I gained so much from that, but I would have loved to have broad discussions about health economics with
my You know, I'll just share this anecdote. When I was chief of breast cancer here, and it was a growing service, as I hired people and brought on young people, one of the conversations I had with every one of them was a basic about how to maximize their contribution to the 403B and take full advantage of building a retirement nest egg. And it was interesting to me that for many of them, nobody had ever had a basic economic discussion with them like that.
Yeah, I used to give a lecture, like a financial literacy lecture, to the residents and students that work with the very basic.
I think it's better now. I actually do think more attention is being paid now, and I think that this is a good thing, like the availability of the leadership training that we discussed earlier and so forth. I think there's more awareness. Coming back to the basic question, should there be some formal training or teaching in medical school? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it kind of goes back also to speaking the language, right? I think if we were more educated on those topics, we'd be able to engage our management partners a little bit better. Before we leave the topic of practicality on leadership training, I wanted to ask you specifically about leadership coaches. This is something that I think maybe listeners will know. Famously, it's like one of my biggest regrets that I was offered this as part of a negotiation a while back and didn't like explicitly ask for it. Didn't work out. I now have an opportunity to kind of get it again. I saw that you mentioned somewhere, potentially that podcast, maybe in a blog, that you have a history working with leadership coaches or a coach. My question is, have you found that helpful? And then if you can give an aspect about how that relationship specifically has been helpful to you in your day-to-day career of leadership roles in these organizations.
So again, my answers are probably too long. There's multiple aspects to this. Something that I've learned after I was interested in assuming this role, first of all, my predecessor, Alan Lichter, I think had a coach throughout his time. I may be wrong about that. I don't want to speak for him, but he spoke often about input and guidance that he got from his coach. And that's important because somebody I deeply respected, who I hoped to approach if I could in some way, taking over the role, was revealing something to me that earlier in my career, I didn't understand was a strength. I thought having a coach, maybe it reflected some perceived weakness. But it turns out that many people in leadership engage coaches on an ongoing basis throughout their careers as a resource. So when I took my role, again, making this transition from physician leader to essentially an organizational CEO, I knew full well that there were huge gaps in my knowledge. And in order to make sure I didn't fall flat on my face, I hired a coach for, I think it was weekly or biweekly sessions for the first couple of years that I did this, to talk through the various situations that I was confronting and learn the basics of how others dealt with this. I've learned a lot from that. You know, one of them, I think you asked, you know, what's my, one of my take homes. Certainly, yeah. There are a couple of refrains that have become part of my mantra whenever I'm talking to our leadership team and others. On the external side, I'll frequently say, what problem are we solving here? I mean, it's a dumb, simple question. I'm not the first person to think of it. But maintaining the discipline to always be asking that question 100% of the time is one example of a benefit of the coaching discipline. The related one, which relates to the idea of coaching, was whenever we're confronted with what seems like a new problem, one of my first questions is, who else has had this problem and how have they solved it already? Because just like you learn from the coach, you learn from others. And then I want to broaden the lens a little bit. There are, I think the number is 90,000 trade associations, professional societies, and the like just in the United States. So the notion that you're doing something that's unique running one of these organizations is easily challenged. But there's strength in that. So there are organizations of these organizations' leaderships, and I take advantage of those. I participate in a number of collaborative efforts, narrowly with CEOs of other professional societies and broadly with leaders of many kinds of groups outside of medicine, because you learn from all of them. So I'm giving this long answer because I think that there are useful inputs, useful learnings from a number of sources. To this day, I've maintained a relationship with the person who was my coach, and I still talk very regularly with him. It turns out I don't pay him anymore, but it doesn't seem to have changed that much. We still
Yeah, no, that's a great answer. I think it's funny. There's a lot packed in there. And I think just simply you hear these things like not reinventing the wheel, but the point that you sort of engage with people, even potentially outside the narrow field of medical oncology, just on, you know, leadership of large organizations. I think that's really smart. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
There's an organization called ASAE, which does training for leadership. And I'm always amazed when I go to it because I find myself sitting at a table with like audiologists and geologists and architects, and their trade associations and societies are pretty much like ours. They educate their members through meetings and publications. They advocate for beneficial policies, and they, in some cases, support and conduct research. Doesn't sound so different, right?
Right. No, it's very similar. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, it's, I bet you that a lot of the problems they face are very similar to.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. It's eye opening.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. I think I was actually one of the things that Simil and I are both doing that's been very nice. And it's still in medicine. We're both doing this fellowship. We're doing integrative medicine. But one of the things that's nice about it is you get to engage with people outside oncology. And I think sometimes you forget, like, oncology feels like the whole world sometimes when you're working in it and you're getting in the issues, deep in the issues. Nice to remember there's areas of medicine that don't, you know, have anything to do with oncology, and they have a very different view of the medical world. And then if you talk to people even outside medicine, like you said, it's a different view of the same problems with just different context.
But the practical point is there are practical learnings from them.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to pivot a little bit, and I wanted to try to talk about your leadership of ASCO. I'm very impressed with it. Not that you need my compliment, but I feel like ASCO is run very well among oncology organizations. They do a lot. I know people and physicians get a lot of value out of them. One thing that I wanted to ask about specifically was about, you know, quote, serving the organization in your role. It is huge, right? It's a giant organization. Famously, you serve academic, community, private practice, medical oncologists. I know those terms are getting a little squishy these days, but also globally, you serve international physicians, patient advocates, clinicians that aren't physicians. My question is, how do you get feedback from all these different individuals and these different stakeholders, industry as well, for example, and how do you incorporate that feedback while you manage the society?
There's a lot of ways, I think, to approach that question. The first is to recognize the role and function of a professional society. We are a volunteer-led organization. I am the employee of the board of directors, and my job is to deliver on the goals that the board of directors sets through ongoing strategic planning. That's like a 101 kind of a comment, but that's the fundamental way an organization runs. It wouldn't matter if there's one employee or 500, the board holds the chief executive accountable. And we remind ourselves of that all the time. So that motivates us to make sure as best as we can, we understand in our domains what the issues are that confront our community. And when I say our domains, I want to be clear. We have three: education, research, and quality care. But through the process of strategic planning, which can sound dry and jargon-filled, I fear, sometimes to people in medicine, you strive to develop a very clear vision for what it is you're trying to do. And then you want the organization's resources and staff to be continually aligned in service of that goal. And this is the answer to your question. The fundamental delivery for us is a continuous improvement in the quality of cancer care around the world. Now, that's not easily measurable. So it begs the question of what metrics you set for yourself and so forth. We could maybe talk about that if you want. But that alignment, that single purpose, that reason that we're all here ultimately is to improve quality of care. And it's not a goal that you can reach. You're always doing it. It's a journey. That is the lens through which we hear and seek input from all the various stakeholders. And through that lens, the stakeholders aren't that different.
I mean, can you give an example of a metric that you use for yourself? I know that's like a very broad question. There could be many, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And but it's a fundamental struggle about which key performance indicators you set for yourself, whether you're talking about 1 year or multi-year. We have a pretty long list of metrics, but they really are tests of the impact or reach or growth of our core programs. So they're surrogates for this. If more people are coming to our meetings, just to give you an example, then presumably we're reaching more of the broad multidisciplinary professional community nationally and globally. And presumably we're nudging quality of care through what they're learning. So we use meeting attendance. We use distribution of our journals, downloads of the articles. We might use downloads of our guidelines as an example. We will, of course, use membership numbers, and we'll use engagement of those members. And we do that through a complicated metric, but it incorporates the activities that lead to the attainment of FASCO, the fellowship and the fellow of ASCO designation and so forth. In that regard, it's a pretty conventional set of metrics, but it's a little bit, you know, like if you were combating climate change, you might say, well, I want to measure, you know, ocean temperatures over time, but because it's multifactorial and the thing you're doing, like I'm just making it up, limiting fossil fuel consumption might or might not nudge that temperature with or without the confluence of other factors. You can't really peg yourself to the ocean temperature directly, even if that's your goal. And we don't even have exactly a global measure for quality of cancer care, but that is our goal.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I do want to ask, I again encourage people to go listen to your prior podcast. One of the things that sort of inspired us to ask you on was just about your explanation and kind of description of how ASCO does manage different topics and, you know, different priorities of the membership. Yeah. In that case, the maintenance of certification. But I thought you gave a really nice description of kind of how that's been managed so far.
That is worth describing. So one of the things that concerned me was the risk that an individual opinionated leader, be it a CEO or a president or a vocal member of a board, might influence engagement and positions that the organization takes. And while, again, it's never perfect, one of the things we've done in the last few years is to codify through algorithm which issues we would get engaged in or not, and how. And what I'm not saying that we made a catalog of the issues. No, what we made is an algorithm for decision making, having to do with, for example, is this related to oncology or not? Does it have a bearing on our membership or not? Does our voice have the potential to make a difference or not? And it breaks these decisions down so that when there's a Supreme Court decision, regulatory affairs topic or something else that might in some people's minds be relevant, we're able to consistently navigate that, speak or not speak, in a way that wouldn't be seen as arbitrary and capricious.
No, I think that's really important. And like to drive home what you said, that it sort of protects the organization against the problem where the way it acts is dependent on the person that's in charge, right? And it sounds like there's a very intentional effort to make sure that you get consistent quote positions, I guess, even if they do evolve over time from ASCO, not related to who's leading.
Yeah. Consistent approach, I would say, is an upgrade.
Yeah.
And I will say, since we're talking about leadership, there's a philosophical consistency here. All the senior leadership at ASCO write succession plans for themselves each year as well. And my point is that the organization is bigger than any individual, and the organization needs to be healthy despite potential changes in leadership. And it has to have its own DNA that gets, if you will, transmitted.
So I was interested in discussing a bit this concept of physician versus non-physician leadership of large organizations. And I want to be very broad with this. The reason I'm interested is that my own company sort of has a setup where there's physicians sort of integrated into the highest levels of leadership through this dyad program where they're sort of paired with administrators. And I actually find that to be very helpful. I feel like it fosters a clinician-friendly sort of culture in the organization that gives that perspective to the leadership that may not have experience working as a clinician. So as we were prepping for this, I was reading through ASCO's bylaws, and I saw that they mandate an all-physician board of directors. There's diversity built in there, meaning that by specialty, as well as U.S. and international representatives to the board of directors. And so what are your thoughts about physician versus non-physician leadership in large organizations in oncology? What works, what doesn't? I know that previously when we were talking, you mentioned there's sort of pros and cons there that could be worth discussing.
So one of the things that I've come to learn is when you look at medical professional societies, I think about a third of them at this point are led by physicians, and two-thirds are led by society or association management experts, people with MBAs or law degrees and so forth. And my point is that, again, there's a complementarity there. There are strengths and weaknesses to each approach. And I'm not sure, I wouldn't say with certainty that there's a single best answer. I think ASCO's answer at the moment has been right, and I'll expand on that for just a second. ASCO, in its bylaws, requires not just the physician leadership you described on the board, but specifically that the chief executive has to be a physician. And you heard me allude to this before when we're talking about the coaching. Taking on the role of leading what is conventionally a mid-sized American corporation, forget about the topic for a moment, but in terms of employee number, cash flows, resources, and so on, this is just a mid-sized corporation. I wouldn't say necessarily that an academically sheltered physician like I was can come into this position with confidence and claim that they're a maven at doing this. They have to come in, with humility, certainly enough humility to know that they need to be turning for help and support to others. Now, in the case of ASCO, it's easier, paradoxically, to do this because when I got to ASCO, number one, there was a very, very strong chief legal officer, now chief operating officer. There was a very, very strong chief financial officer. There were very strong department heads and vice presidents in terms of those leading those departments. There was actually also, I'll point out, a chief medical officer who was very strong at the time. And my point is, I relied on their expertise. I solicited their guidance, and along with the coach, filled in or tried to fill in the gaps in my own knowledge. The other thing I'll say, which you haven't asked about, but I recognized that for a variety of reasons, we needed to reconsider how we did strategic planning and budgeting. And I hired a company they worked with us, I think it was for 2 years, quietly and gently, because I didn't want to be a bull in a china shop, revising the organization structure and revising the approach to strategic planning and revising the approach to budgeting so that I started in 2016, and I think it was that by late 17, we had completely reconfigured this in a relatively non-disruptive way, which is to say without disenfranchising the staff leadership. At least I think that's true. And so I think that that the physician who comes into this should do so with humility. I'm going to close with something in the other direction. I think physicians have unique strengths as business and administrative leaders. In summary, we are used to making difficult decisions and living with them, even when later it turns out that there has emerged information that we couldn't have known originally that makes the decision different. And that's a pretty big responsibility, but it happens in medicine all the time. In 1993, I had certain drugs to give patients. But if it was 2023, I would have different drugs and treatments and better outcomes in many cases. All I can say is we all do our best at the time. That ability to make a decision and live with it is a strength that physicians bring, I think, to leadership. And I know that, you know, you may want to talk about COVID, but it really played out at that time.
I was just going to say, I think that that's such a, it's such an on the nose point for what I have felt has been a struggle with the way that educating the public and the way that physicians and scientists are sort of viewed right now, at least, you know, the sort of mainstream opinion. I think this idea of like, you know, having an opinion, letting it change with new information and having people be comfortable with that is something that like frustrated me a lot through the pandemic and through kind of the post-pandemic that I think, you know, I wish when I just say we did better, I mean, I kind of just mean like everyone overall, the entire enterprise of science and medicine, it's not anyone specific.
Yeah, but I'm really reflecting on those early days of March of 2020. Mm-hmm. As a physician, second of all, having come, I didn't mention this before, but out of a very strong infectious disease internal medicine program, it was very clear to me what was going to happen. And I still remember, this is not bravado on my part. I think it's all just human nature, but I remember explicitly telling our vice presidents in those first days of March that we were going to go home and become fully remote. And they said, on a Wednesday, I think it was Wednesday, it had to be March, maybe it was March 11th. I think I said, we're going to go home and that's going to be it. And they said, well, let's just try a day. And I knew that it wasn't going to just be a day by the time the Monday came around. But, you know, people just had such a hard time, everybody in the whole country, with the idea of the lockdown. And by the way, I'm not even saying it was right or wrong at this point. All I'm saying is we made the decision and we were able to execute it with clarity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think I wanted to ask you before we move on, I do want to talk a little bit about COVID and your experience there. I think you gave great advice there. I really appreciate that as physicians think about leadership, we all talk about we need more clinicians in the room. A lot of these people don't know how to manage clinics. You know, there's a lot of like kind of sometimes it's approached with a little bit of tension where there should be maybe more physician leadership. So I think your comments on being humble and recognizing what physicians are not strong at the necessary skills to be able to do these things. But setting that aside, do you think we need more physician leadership? Do you think we need a formal pathway to get more people into these offices and kind of at the table in positions like yours?
Well, my position, you know, it's organization by organization, right? So in my current position, it's just a bylaws requirement. You would have to vote and change the bylaws in order to not have a physician CEO. I'm optimistic that those who follow me will come in with much more business and formal leadership training than I had because of age. I mean, you know, I'm from an older generation at this point, but I think behind me, people have greater opportunities to acquire these skills, as we were discussing before.
Yeah.
I think there is something, Simmel made this point before about economics. In the end, either economic success or acceptable economic impact and clear impact on quality, one of those two arguments has to be made, I think, at the institutional level for what you're describing. And they should be makeable. But that's how I would focus with clarity always. It goes back to the what problem are we solving? It isn't ego. We don't want to be there just because we want to be there. There has to be a reason. Our impact on the clinic improves high quality care. It increases clinical trial enrollment. It decreases waste, something that can be demonstrated. It isn't, if you can't do that, then I think it's going to be a harder argument.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, that's a good point.
You're about to approve a new patient plan. How do you know this plan is providing the highest quality care? Are you sure your plan is safe and effective? With ClearCheck from RadFormation, you can breathe easy. Get instant access to critical information you need, like dose constraints comparisons, potential collision detection, and key plan parameter verifications. Make informed decisions with confidence and ensure the best possible outcome. Visit RadFormation.com today to learn more about improved quality and safety with ClearCheck.
I know that you touched on this a little bit on our podcast. You've spoken about this elsewhere as well, but I wanted to ask a little bit about your experience leading ASCO kind of through COVID and the changes that came through it. So one thing that's been brought up is this move to remote work. I think speaking very broadly, this is something people even outside medicine sort of experienced with the move to COVID. I was curious about your thoughts moving to the sort of remote work for ASCO staff, as well as engaging physician and clinician volunteers that don't work for the organization but volunteer, that move. And then also, where do you feel like we are today compared to where we might have been, say, in 2021? I call it like deep COVID, but you know, we were fully in all the changes and kind of living that new life.
So let me start by saying that ASCO, long before COVID, because of limited space in terms of just real estate, had hired two consultants and implemented what's called a ROWE, R-O-W-E, or Results Only Work Environment. This was an idea that was publicized in a book called Why Work Sucks and How to Fix It, by two authors, Kelly Ressler and Jody Thompson. And they were famous because I think, if memory serves, they advised Best Buy and other big companies years ago on how to improve it. It comes back to many of the topics we're talking about. In a very central way, under a ROWE, everybody's their own CEO. Because what happens under a ROWE is each person is wholly responsible for delivering whatever they're supposed to be delivering. It raises, frankly, the challenge for management, because even like our metrics discussion before, time with your rear end in a desk chair in the office isn't the metric. The metric is the work product. And being able to see that or assess that, I think, is a harder challenge than asking, did somebody punch the clock from 9 to 5, 5 days a week? So we had implemented a ROWE, and through that, a number of staff in the what's called the DMV, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, where our headquarters is, had taken to working off hours at their own schedule, whatever it was. One of the challenges in a ROWE is you actually, when you're implementing it, you know, you push the staff to go to the movies on a Tuesday afternoon or do something that feels completely untethered. So that's part one. Part two is we had a small number of employees in a couple of dozen states, I think, at that point, working remotely anyway. And we even at times have had some employees in other countries. So our culture was one of responsibility, accountability, independence, and freedom from the narrow requirements of a 9 to 5 office situation. So that's our background. That made that decision, that inevitable decision to go all remote, much easier for us than it would have been for many other organizations. That's a simple truth. So we did it. We, like everybody, muddled our way through the rollout of Teams, the rapid spread of Zoom and uptake of it. We had all been doing hybrid video conferencing with WebEx, I think it was, before. It was always a subpar kind of an experience. But I think that, you know, we embraced technology to make it work. And so I think that's maybe as much to say about the initial transition as one can. I don't think we're unique. I do think we're all living through a new era. In medicine, you have to go to the hospital or to the clinic. But I will just say, outside of that kind of hands-on care, even in medicine, there's a higher degree of remote work, I think, on the days when people are not in clinic. And for us at ASCO, it is, I think, a new reality that our staff are not coming back to the office at the levels that they were before. Two things about that. One is they just don't have to anymore. And that means the daily grind of commuting and so forth are a bigger factor for people, dissuading them. And the second is even through COVID, a good number of people moved further out of the central or the Alexandria region for us, but the central business districts of many cities. And it's a financial challenge or economic challenge for them to come back. I'll say this. We have not adopted at the staff level to this day a mandate for in-office appearance. There are activities for which you have to be there. But what I mean is we don't have a number of days per week or hours or anything. What we've tried to do is sell everybody. And I mean that literally, sell everybody on the value of coming to the office by highlighting the benefits of being there. And let me be even more plain spoken, the joy and pleasure of being there. So for the listeners who don't know, our offices in suburban Washington are 245 miles from where I live in New York City. But I get myself into that office nearly every week of the year for several days at least per week. And the days when I'm there, the senior staff are typically there. The meetings are in person. The interactions are lively and rewarding. And it filters down to some degree to other staff. We're not getting to where we were.
No, I think that that's a really good point. We've had this discussion some too, just internally in our group, just as some of our staff members' models are moving towards more remote work. It's, you know, I think everyone sees the benefits of that, but I genuinely do feel that there is like at least a cultural benefit to having people together in person once in a while, at the very least. So I think that's
I think more than once in a while. I think it should be every week. But I stop short of saying that there's any specific time or hourly requirement. The one thing I'll point out is we have our leadership meetings in person on Tuesdays. Mm-hmm. And most of our senior staff are there on Tuesdays. And then they will organize other team meetings on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. So it builds out to a degree.
Yeah. And I like what you really said about this, like encouraging people to go see a movie on Tuesday during the day, this kind of blowing out flexibility and allowing better integration of work-life sort of balance. But the flip of that is then you now, like, work has access to your time that might have been life before. Let me ask you, I wanted to ask you about ASCO engaging physician volunteers. It's a little bit COVID related, maybe only that maybe things are ramping up a bit now with more and more virtual programming, more things offered by societies. Those are all made by volunteer clinicians or physicians. What are your thoughts about that growing sort of demand for volunteer time of physicians and how that might be impacting work-life balance in a field that it may be an issue?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because, to be frank, it always feels like it's the other way. We're blessed that we have many more people asking to volunteer than we have opportunities. And I think, although you didn't ask about this here, the time spent serving a community, and I don't mean only narrowly our professional society, but many other aspects of life, whether it's religious organization or other community-based organizations, all of that seems in the aggregate to serve as a nice antidote to burnout. And people say when they spend time with us at ASCO, maybe because it's a break in the routine, maybe because it's some freedom to work on other issues, they say it reduces their burnout. I don't know how to objectively measure that, but I think it might be true. So up until now, at least, I think that there's a real traction to serve in these volunteer roles. What you didn't ask, but I do think is a growing challenge, is more and more institutions, not the docs, but the institutions, are recognizing the time that this takes and are putting some limits on it.
Yeah, the volunteer physician, I worked for one organization that would give you credit for those volunteer activities. And it was like 3% of salary or 2% of salary. You had to document your hours. And there was a bonus paid out for that.
Wow.
A lot of issues with that organization. I'm just focusing on one very positive aspect of it. They did, like, if you wrote journal articles, you could put that in and that would be part of your bonus. And this all added up to like 15% times your base, which was a lot of money, you know, for what was called free work before. I wanted to ask you about, you know, you're talking about in your setting, in a corporate setting, remote work, like I'm doing it with the digital health company. I've never met anyone there except my boss was in town to meet with Blue Cross Blue Shield. We had dinner, but other than that, I've never met anybody. And I find that interesting because I have a good rapport and I like them, but it'd be a different scenario if we got to get together in person. We're trying to make it happen, but I agree with once in a while in person. But in a clinic setting, I want to jump in like telemedicine or virtual clinic. What's gained, what's lost, and should it be reimbursed? And I know that's a big question. Should it be reimbursed the same? And it's interesting because this is a topic in our specialty right now where we're talking about on-site versus not on-site versus virtual versus direct. And it's just interesting because I don't know the answer. I don't feel that strongly about how it should be, but I'm just curious what you may think about that.
Well, I would start with the big picture. As a professional, giving advice and taking responsibility, you should be reimbursed. And it's an artifact, telemedicine versus in person, in the sense that because we didn't have technology when the field started, we think, of course, the in-person is the gold standard and the remote is somehow lesser or not even encoded into the reimbursement schemes in some cases. Whether it's worth as much, more or less, is a different discussion. But yes, it should be reimbursed is my answer. Number two, in terms of the what's gained and what's lost, I think that's a challenge because there are huge gains in the ability to communicate, even if it's just the fact that patients can call my cell phone. I mean, as a patient myself and as a physician, I find all that pretty rewarding. However, we've even published in recent weeks some pieces on limits and how you, again, coming back to burnout, avoid overstressing physicians by having them be too available. And I think these are really important topics to work out. Because they're so complicated, I'm going to stick to the simple. One, I think the availability of telemedicine is a huge plus. We learned during COVID that it's broadly safe and that it can make a huge positive impact on both clinical and research interactions. And the second is it should, of course, be reimbursed.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree. I guess I'm on the younger side of things. But I really missed the contact. Like, I hug patients. I like to put my hand on their hand when it's a tough conversation.
Of course. I hope we all feel that way.
I think that like when I came back and I moved to Michigan, Michigan was super strict with everything. And it took a long time to be able to like get close to people again and not have the masks on. And I really liked getting back. I was like, this is what it feels like to be a doctor again. But at the same time, the flexibility of it for follow-ups, for routine follow-ups, I felt like I'm wasting my patients' time by making them come in.
Exactly. But I don't think it should be set up as an either or.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best relationship is the one where you do see them in person and when they need you and it's inconvenient or whatever, it's remote. I don't think they need to be in juxtaposition.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I lean towards there should be reimbursement parity for both types of visits. But
I stopped short of that. I'm not sure about the parity or not parity question. That's a very deep technical question, but there should be reimbursement.
Yeah. I'm not that's something I lean towards it. I'd have to kind of study it more, but like it at times it feels like it's very similar, close enough, but yeah, other people will make those decisions, I suppose.
Well, so let me ask you one quick follow-up question just to close out this section. We talked, about E&M visits or kind of counseling, right? That's, I think a lot of people can envision how that makes a lot of sense and how remote options for that really increase access for people and increase flexibility. What about more things like therapy? So I'm seeing discussion of home chemotherapy. There's probably not going to be a home radiotherapy anytime soon, but even things like taking some diagnostics at home for clinical trials, I've seen more about decentralized trial strategies and trying to do more things close to home or at home. Do you have any thoughts there? We can focus, I guess, on home chemotherapy. That's a more narrow question.
Right. But even home chemotherapy is probably not as narrow as you might think. We've had home chemotherapy for decades. People take capecitabine and other drugs at home.
Yeah.
Oral. Right. So it makes the point that it's all about risk benefit. And therefore, it's about the specific drugs. There are non-chemotherapy drugs that have the risk of acute infusion reactions, where even though they're not chemotherapy, they shouldn't be given at home. And there are others that can be given at home and can be given, sub-Q even and so forth. So I just don't think that the framing is on the modality. To me, the framing should be on the risk and safety. And I think there are probably decent numbers of drugs that could be safely given at home, and there are some that can't. The related issue, which touches back on the telemedicine question, is the responsibility for outcomes and protecting patients in those circumstances typically still flows up to that treating and ordering physician. And that should be accounted for in reimbursement as well.
That makes a lot of sense. It's like devil's in the details, right? It's hard to make these kind of blanket statements. I want to keep moving. We have one more topic before I want to let Simil close out with the hot seat. I wanted to ask a little bit about engaging the public with science communication. It's a huge topic that I'm very interested in. And I wanted to kind of kick off that topic by mentioning this Common Sense Oncology movement. I'll link to it. We've had them on the show to talk about it before. They're one example that I really like, and they basically talk about, I think their tagline is outcomes that matter for patients. And it's really like this idea that we have lots of ways that we engage the public in oncology. There is a potential concern that there's like lots of hype and spin these days about positive findings and trials. There's a move towards looking at surrogate primary endpoints instead of, quote, per them, outcomes that matter, specifically survival and quality of life. And they lay out these pillars for their work that they're trying to address as an advocacy group. And I wanted to focus on their third pillar, which is evidence communication. They want to improve patient, public, and policymaker understanding of cancer treatment options. And so I wanted to ask you specifically, when we're engaging the public about therapies, cancer, and information, how do you feel like we're doing? And what do you feel like is the future of that topic?
That's a really hard question about how we're doing, because obviously we can always do better. And I don't know what the basis of comparison exactly is.
That's fair.
So I'm struggling, I guess, a little bit with giving us a grade on that, if you will. I don't know. But I do think we can do better. So I will say the following about that. Number one, I think that the idea of meaningful endpoints, endpoints that matter to patients, is critically important. It's obvious when you have a drug, a precision oncology, and a targeted therapy that transforms the natural history of a disease so profoundly that you hardly need even a phase three trial to see it. That's one category. And those advances are real. We see them now more than we used to, but they're still relatively uncommon. For the more typical advances that are often, I think, valuable and important, but are much more subtle, I think there is a discussion, of course, to be had about how important they are to patients. Some of them are very important, some are not. And so we can probably leave it at that for the moment. The education part, maybe I'll answer that by just talking a little bit about something you may not know we're doing at ASCO. So for years, we have had a patient education website called cancer.net. Its origin and history is not particularly relevant at the moment, but we've been proud of it because it is non-commercial and it has won a huge number of awards for the quality of the content. If we're going to be honest with ourselves, it has been somewhat of a challenge to us because it is not the first place most people go to when they are first, as patients, thinking about cancer and seeking to learn. Where do they turn? They turn to the American Cancer Society. So we've begun a partnership, a collaboration to be precise, with the American Cancer Society. About 2 years ago, we began to cross-refer patients seeking certain kinds of information from cancer.net and cancer.org. And what that's meant is, again, patients seeking information can get survivorship care plans, treatment summaries that are ASCO's format, via the ACS. And when you go to the cancer.net and you're looking for prevention and screening guidelines, typically something the ACS has generated, they are directed there. Later this year, around the annual meeting, we expect to be able to announce a deeper, broader collaboration in that regard. And my goal and the goal of the ACS is unified here, aligned. It is to ensure that more and more patients have more and more access to higher quality, or I should say the highest quality information available. So I think that's going to address part of what you're talking about, which is pushing out vetted high quality information in a way that's even more broadly accessible.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And it's like one of the things we, I have a podcast with two patient advocates, and we talk a lot about, you know, desires for the future. And one of the things I think they are constantly asking for is easier access of information that might be available before or right at the point of care, when you have to make that decision potentially in an emotionally, you know, high emotion situation. And so I feel like this collaboration really could do a lot for
that. It's premature, but I'm just saying, stay tuned, watch this space. We're very motivated, especially by the challenge that came out of the White House in Moonshot 2.0, which was explicitly to improve access and collaborate.
Do you have any efforts where ASCO is doing anything specific to try to, I guess, improve or address the quality of communication in the lay media? So like, for example, when they cover the conference or things like that?
Well, we do that on an ongoing basis through direct engagement with the science reporters. We, of course, host a good number of them at the annual meeting. We have regular outreach. And I think, again, there is an opportunity to do more if we have better or broader reach through our collaborative efforts going forward.
That makes sense. All right. So I, you know, those are all the really questions that I have for you. I know we covered a number of topics. I wanted to leave similar time. You've had a really interesting career in life, and so I wanted to leave him time to kind of ask you some questions, maybe unscience related, that are more like hot seat type questions. So, Sim, why don't you go ahead?
A little scared, but okay.
Yeah.
these are softballs, because fortunately for you, you've had such an interesting background that I'm not going to ask you about pizza today. So, I do like to look at what people have researched in the past. Tell me a little bit about earthworm muscular physiology.
Yeah, this was where I should have been flunked out and never allowed into medical school. So when I was in high school, I think, it may have been middle school, but I think it was high school, my mother was convinced that I needed to go study science and become a doctor. And so I was signed up for what was called the Hahnemann Summer Science Program, I think it's called. And the thing about it is no part of this exists anymore. Hahnemann, as you know, famously was merged with the Medical College of Pennsylvania, taken over by Allegheny Healthcare, bankrupted, I guess, once, taken over by Tenet. Now the remnants of it are the Drexel University Medical College. And the actual hospital is closed and I think on its way to being a condominium or something at Broad and Vine in Philadelphia. So that's the Hahnemann story. But at any rate, I was in my summer assigned into a lab where a famous, at the time, muscle researcher taught me how to grind up. You said earthworms are, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a high percentage of the earthworm body is just striated muscle. And I had to grind them up and run blots on the myosin, and it was under various experimental conditions. But honestly, I was oblivious. I didn't understand. I muddled through it. My report at the end of the year was, or the end of the summer, was an embarrassment. The good news is nobody asked me about that when I actually did apply to medical school.
That is fascinating. Those summer programs are so interesting. I mean, like, I a lot of people transition to medicine or science careers after having gone to those. I mean, maybe, you know, I don't know if they're causation or whatever, but it's always interesting to see what people work on at that stage. So one more research question. So we talked briefly about, so you're one of the authors of the CALGB, the Hughes study for 70 and up women with low risk breast cancer. And that's an emission study. And of course, you know, it was a great boon for many older women who were possibly getting unnecessary treatment. So I want to ask you, like, do you look at radiation as a binary variable here? Or now that, for example, I can do it in 5 days and get the same outcome versus 5 weeks with the Hughes study, does that calculus change for you?
Well, it does, and in part, but let me just say, it's an interesting question a few minutes after our discussion about the common sense oncology endpoints discussion, because it makes the point that there may not be a single right answer, but there may be an answer based on what a patient values. So even before the shortening of radiation, for one patient, the fact that there's no survival impact in a low-risk cohort of older patients with low-stage breast cancer would be a great argument against radiation. And for the very next patient in the identical biological and physiological situation, the possibility of having to come back and deal with a local recurrence would be so disturbing that for her, the radiation would be worth it, right? So your question, I think, allows us to instead focus on what really matters, which was individual values. And I don't think it changes dramatically if you go to 5 days.
Yeah, I guess I think of the same as, like, if a tamoxifen is a similar, you know, it's a little bit different, but it's a similar argument for in the elderly population. And if you said it could be a 3-month daily pill rather than 5 years, then I would push my, if they can get the same outcome, I would want them to take it. You know, I would say, well, that benefit's there, and it's only 3 months. You can tolerate these body aches for 3 months, or, you know, hot flushes, and it's such a good benefit because the therapeutic window changes as it becomes a shorter and possibly milder treatment.
Well, I think there's some subtlety to this, frankly. I'll push back a little.
Yeah.
The argument for adjuvant systemic therapy is an overall survival impact.
Right.
So if you don't value the small overall survival impact, then your argument holds.
Yeah.
The difference with the Hughes study is we weren't able to talk about that.
Right.
And that's, I think, an important distinction. I'll also point out, although it was ahead of its time, you know, what the Hughes article did was led the way in terms of more generally in breast cancer, reducing overtreatment. Once the Oncotype DX brand name 21 gene recurrence score became available, I can't remember the exact statistic, but I think in a short order, we reduced adjuvant chemotherapy administration 10 or 15%. So the docs really don't want to give the therapy that's not
useful,
but they just need the confidence to know where they can do that responsibly. And I think that's a little different than the tamoxifen question. If 1 year of tamoxifen was as effective as 5 years, which it was not in any studies, then yeah, you would always choose that.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. That study is the third part about that study is the axillary surgery. I mean, about,
right,
you know, 40%, 50% got zero sampling, anything. No.
And look at the, you know, as we speak, I think it was just 1 or 2 weeks ago, the New England Journal has evidence that you don't have to complete a dissection even when you have a macro met.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have confirmation for that for very little dissection. Yeah.
Right. So I think you start to think about these not as narrow little nodes, but part of an overall idea, which is we want to keep improving overall outcomes, but we also at the same time are sensitive and we don't want to overtreat anybody.
Yeah. So I'm doing an integrative medicine fellowship. Matt is as well. He just started his course, and exercise, weight loss, these things are super important. The breast cancer data is fantastic for exercise and weight loss, like the outcomes, and discussing it with patients and like recurrence risk with weight loss with obesity is higher. How do you think we should work that into our relationship with the patient? And do you think there's going to be a way to, I got to ask it, like monetize that type of counseling or treatment essentially, because some of the data, the recurrence reduction is like bigger than what we do, you know, bigger than with radiation. And whether that's true or not, like it's not randomized data, but it's very.
Right. You just said something really important.
What's that?
It's not randomized data.
It's not random. No, I get that. But there's something there. There's signals, right? If you see so many things.
Yeah. Well, I am no more or less skeptical here than I am across the rest of medicine. For me, it doesn't matter what the intervention is. It doesn't matter what the prelim is. You need, for these kinds of, forgive me, small impact treatments, randomized data.
Yeah.
Full stop. So that's one thing. Number two, I would just say how to monetize it, which I think is two questions, at least, is really a question of how we make sure that valid guidance and advice is reimbursed so that it is implemented at the same pace as expensive interventions? That's really your question. And yeah. that goes back in a way to the E&M coding discussion from before. And I think it's predicated on solid evidence of two things. One is that the intervention really makes a difference. And the second is some assessment of how much time and effort it actually takes to make that happen and who has to do it. So those are, I guess, unresolved for us at the moment. There is something else that I would say. Early in the discussion, one of you pointed out the approximately 20% of healthcare or GDP that's related to healthcare. From a societal point of view, there are huge potential economic benefits here to implementing this if this is true. And I guess the economics question is how to make sure that those are both recognized, quantified, and the effort it takes to get those are rewarded appropriately.
Yeah. You said something very interesting about, so I've been thinking about like sort of levels of evidence that we have. So if you're a clinician that's working today, right, you only have the evidence you have. You can't, like, you can wish for more, but you have what you have. And I had an important lesson in this integrative fellowship where the pitch was made that if the risk of harm of a potential intervention is low, then maybe you can tolerate a little less evidence there. But something you said that I think was really interesting is if the effect is small, that you really should demand a higher level of evidence. This is something that, like, I mean, both of these are not profound, innovative statements or things that I've thought about before, but putting it that way is really interesting and I hadn't really thought about it. And so that is a fair critique and an important demand, I think, of the exercise physiology or cancer oncology exercise.
Well, it's a question of what you're asking people. So I will say that we have more than a few lessons from the past where we were certain that things had an effect and they didn't. But when you say to a patient that there's something that's under their control to some degree, and then they either fail to implement it or have a bad outcome, when those two things come together, you can be by accident or inadvertently placing a responsibility and even guilt on a poor person who doesn't deserve it.
Yeah.
You mentioned your undergrad MD combined program. So as a 6-year program, I was at a school with a 7-year program. I didn't get accepted to it, but I was friends with so many people in that program at Northwestern.
Famous one.
Yeah, it was a tough one. It was 7 years, 3.0, no MCAT. I mean, these guys had a great undergrad experience. They're starting, I've been looking at this, they're going down. The numbers of these programs are going down. And there's this idea that or the ones that were 6 are turning into 7, or the ones that are 7 years are turning into 8. That being said, across the world, everybody else does shorter programs and starting at age 18. India, UK, most of the European Union countries. I think Australia is similar to ours and Canada is similar to ours. But everybody else has a 5 to 6 year track starting at 17 or 18. So I feel like if we have shortages or distribution issues with physicians, this is a quick, like the lag time to create more medical schools and things like that. Like if we can shorten the training, we can get more docs out there.
Well, if you do the math on that, if you shorten the training and have the same number of slots in med schools, you get a one-time bump.
Right, but people who may not consider doing it.
Either way, but you're still going to graduate after you shorten it. You're still going to graduate the same number per year.
So, the resources are different, right? Like
I'd save a little money. I think, you know, you've asked a question that makes me think of things that I haven't personally thought about maybe ever. The first is maybe it's a luxury to do 4 years of undergrad and 4 years of medical school that wealthier societies can afford. And maybe to your point around the world, the shorter training is sensible when the urgent need is to get the professionals out into the field faster and cheaper, because that part you're for sure you're right about. When I did the program, it has been said to me, and this is, I think I have to take exception to this individually. It was said to me at the time that some of these programs were done to improve the quality of the medical students coming in, that they were getting med students that they wouldn't have gotten if they had gone through 4 years of school, they would have gone elsewhere. It sounds a little, you know, pejorative, and I don't know if it's true, but there was some of that. Some of the programs, as you point out, were hyper-competitive and you would get kicked out along the way. Others were very warm and welcoming. And like mine, you were in unless you got arrested or something, I think. So I don't really know. I haven't followed it enough to know what's happened in the years since. I will say that there are times, given at least personally my interest in things outside of medicine, that I regret not having had more undergraduate experience in life. But I also have enjoyed having all this time in medicine, starting as a physician at 24.
I think like I would have looked as a, I would have valued the 2 years of time, not necessarily 2 years of college. I don't know that the cost of a private university for the means that my parents had made a lot of sense. I think it would have been.
I was still paying my student loans till I was 40.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to end on this. I like looking up New York Times wedding stuff. I read those on Sundays, and I saw that you were once in the New York Times. I got to say, your wife sounds like she has a way cooler career than all of us. And I kind of want her on the show.
Yeah, you didn't just happen onto this because that's from 2003. So that's a result of a Google search for sure.
Yes, it is. But she's a leader at Estee Lauder.
Yes. And she's been there for, I guess, 38 years, I think it is at this point.
That's really neat. I showed my wife that this morning. It's like, check out the guy we're interviewing, but check out his wife. Really cool. Thank you so much for coming. This was awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been fantastic. Any closing thoughts for our listeners or things about leadership? We talked about so many things, but any final comments before we end here?
Well, I would just close with something that I think we did cover in there, but it's maybe a nice putting an end on it. I think, number one, all physicians have leadership skills of some sort or another because of the roles that we fill and the responsibilities we're in. Two, we can always learn a little more, and some of the conventional teaching about leadership can be helpful to us, and we should embrace that if we're given the opportunity and even seek it out. And number three is that I think younger folks have even more opportunities in this regard. I do think that while there are still lots of gaps, I do think there's more awareness now than there used to be of the formality of leadership training and more opportunities, therefore, to gain it. And I guess the last thing I'd say is I would hope that physicians would embrace this aspect of career, because it's through engagement, both institutionally and more broadly with the public, that we can effect positive change.
That is awesome. Yeah, I really appreciate your time. I think you shared a lot of really nice things with our audience. I'm sure they'll greatly appreciate it as well. Have a great rest of your day. Don't look directly into the sun. I don't know if you're going to go outside for the eclipse thing, but I, again, really appreciate it. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And hopefully at some point in the future, we may talk to you again soon. Maybe at the meeting. Have a good rest of your day. See you later.
Thanks for listening. If you liked our show, please subscribe and leave us a rating. Also, head to photonmedia.org and check out the rest of our content. We hope you're having a great day and look forward to seeing you again soon.